Have you ever been camping and you got a mosquito in your tent at night? It's all quiet. You're trying to sleep and there's a mosquito. It's just like, man, my mic is hot too. Can we, thank you? You know what I mean? You've been camping and it's really quiet. You're trying to get to sleep and there's that mosquito annoying sound. I've got something like that, a real issue like that in my life right now. It's my glasses. They have a smudge on them that I can't get rid of. It all happened. I was watching the hockey game one night, and I'm like, man, my glasses are dirty. And I took them off. I did the whole, you know, shirt thing. Try to clean them. Nothing. I'm like, well, that's weird. There's still a smudge there. So I went through a number of avenues of ways that I clean my glasses with the little spray thing. Nothing. The smudge was still there. I did the whole, I filled up the tub with warm water, sudsed them down. Still nothing. I'm convinced it's my kids. They put something on my glasses and it's this smudge. And I can't even believe I'm talking about it right now because all I can concentrate is every time I look, all I can see is this smudge right there. It's driving me nuts. I've been tracking my progress since it's happened. Bumping my knee on the wall is up a good 73%. Stubbing my toe, a whopping 289%. I mean, I can't see straight with this smudge on my eyeglasses. It's driving me nuts. In fact, I took a little chisel to it to try to get the thing off. That only added scrapes to my glasses, but it's driving me well. I can't see well to begin with, and now my glasses are muddled and muddied up. It hinders my sight. It's distracting me all the time. All I can do is focus on the smudge. I can't see straight, which I've come to think is a great metaphor for life. I can't see straight. In fact, I don't think many of us can see straight. In fact, in the New Testament, if you follow the eyes in the New Testament, you start to pick up that's a real major plot line in Jesus' ministry. Jesus talks a lot about coming to restore sight, and we see him frequently healing the blind. Jesus has come to help us see well. We frequently use these that metaphors, eyes that can actually see. Paul picks up this theme as well. Of course, his great conversion moment is when he sees Christ, and of course, his eyes are blinded, and then scales fall off of his eyes, and he can see straight. And then in one of Paul's most famous passages, he talks about how in life we see dimly through a mirror. One day, hopefully, we will see in full. The eyes are a major theme in the New Testament. And nowhere is it better demonstrated than Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, which we talked about last week. Two passages speak to it. Jesus says this, "The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness." Then later, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." The enormity of truth that Jesus is speaking here is just enormous. We can't see straight. We have to learn to see again. And last week, we talked about how character formation requires intention, and there's no doubt that that's the first step, but it also requires self-knowledge, requires the ability to see ourselves honestly. And that is not so easily achieved. I think in many ways, we're almost strangers to ourselves. We're unable to look past our own personality, so we need help. And the Enneagram is one such tool to help with that. And I want to introduce you to this tool this morning. And I got to be honest, I am in over my head today, way in. The Enneagram is a very complicated thing, and I'm going to try to do it justice in 30 minutes. We will see how I do. But this is going to be the most condensed introduction I can give to the Enneagram. I started this week with 18 pages of notes, and I've narrowed them down to 8. So we'll see what happens with that. But this is just a brief summary, the briefest I could imagine. But my hope this morning is this. For those of you who have no knowledge of the Enneagram, perhaps it will start you on a bit of a journey of self-discovery. For those of you who are familiar with the Enneagram, can I see your hands? Yikes, oh boy. You're going to be judging me the whole time. All right. For those of you familiar with the Enneagram, hopefully there'll be some sort of new insight for you here this morning. So what is the Enneagram? Well, it's a tool to self-discovery. It's a personality typing system that has 9 personality types, and you are one of them. And you have been probably since you were a child. And you'll keep this number with you your whole life. And what each number does is it describes a kind of personality or a persona. And so while all of us are one of these 9 types, what the Enneagram tries to help us see is that your number is actually who you are not. It's one dimension of yourself. And so to truly understand yourself, the Enneagram theory posits this. It says you have to go deeper into your personality so you can understand and then transcend it. Jerome Wagner says this: personality masquerades as our essential self and tricks us into identifying with and believing that a dimension of ourself is our whole self. We corroborate in this deception as a way of defending our true self from certain vulnerabilities and as a way of compensating for certain imagined shortfalls. And so what the Enneagram sort of teaches is this: early in life, we all experience a primary wound or a sense of lack. And what Jake described this morning is a perfect illustration of that. It can be as simple as an offhand comment by someone, an authority figure, a parent perhaps. We experience a primary wound, and because of that, we develop a persona or a personality that helps us cope with that wound or that sense of lack. And all of us are unique, of course, though probably not as unique as we'd like to imagine, but our personas tend to fall into one of 9 categories. And the problem is that we come to believe our persona, our personality, is who we really are. And so the Enneagram is a tool. It's going to help us uncover, identify our personalities so we can transcend them. And it helps us see our fundamental motivations. It helps us see the ways we handle stress, how we can grow. George Box, he was a famous statistician. I like a quote of his. He says, "All models are wrong. Some models are useful." That's how I like to approach the Enneagram. All models are, they get to the truth in some ways, but some of them can be really useful. I think this one's very useful. It's been very useful for me, so I hope it can be for you as well. So what are the 9 types? Well, the basic system is this. It looks confusing, but it's a circle divided into 3 sections. The 3 sections are these: the gut type, the head type, and the heart type. Now, everyone has all 3 of these things, but each triad has a primary issue. So there's an underlying motivator to each personality triad, and each type under that triad has a different lens for interacting with that motivator. So for gut types, anger is the underlying motivator and lens. For head types, it's fear. And for heart types, it's shame. And in those triads, one type will overexpress that, one type will underexpress that, one type will be sort of ambivalent towards that, whether it's anger, fear, or shame. So that's the basic system. Let's dive in. If it seems a little overwhelming at this point, hopefully it'll become a little bit more clear as we go through. And fair warning, these descriptions are hyperbolic. They're stereotypes. They're inflated for a reason to help us try to see ourselves within them. So, one final thing. If you identify your number type, some of this might sting a bit because you start to realize, and if you're looking for your number, try eliminating ones that you are not. So let's start with the instinct, the gut, the anger triad. This triad is fascinating to me. Anger is the key motivator here. So with this triad, 8s tend to overexpress anger, this instinct. Which means this: they can seem angry when you're talking to them, and they don't really understand that. They don't see that. Ones underexpress this instinct, so they sort of bury anger a little bit. It's under the surface. Rarely do they express it. The danger for them is that it can often turn to resentment. And 9s are ambivalent about the anger, which means this: they're not quite in touch with their anger. They're not quite sure if they're angry or not. So let's look at each. And for each number, I'm going to give you a bit of summary, a bit of a package to look with. So let's start with the ones and move backwards. Ones. They tend to see the world through the lens of goodness. They're called the reformers, the perfectionists. Ones operate from a lens of goodness. They are looking for good. And this manifests itself in a number of ways. For those who are an immature one, it can lead to perfectionism and moralism and puritanism. I like to think in terms of images. So when I think of ones, I think of Martin Luther hammering his 95 theses to the Wittenberg door, right? It's like, here is an extended list of wrongs. If we address these 95 things, then things would be good. So I tend to picture ones as Martin Luther's of the world. And what the Enneagram does is it presents to us the wounding message of each type. And the wounding message for one is this: your significance comes from being perfect or right or good. This is what they're attuned to. And of course, they see anger as an imperfection, so they try to bury it or resist it a little bit. And what that does is it can manifest in resentment. Ones have a tendency to be resentful when things are not perfect or right. And of course, their blind spot is they want to avoid anger. And of course, remember the line, we'll do this with each of the types. Jesus, when he talks about the beam in our eye and the speck in someone else's, it's a projection mechanism. We have this thing and we project it onto others. Each type has a projection. And so what ones tend to do is look at others and see them through the lens of they're at fault. Others are not doing it the right way. You see, ones are, they do things by the book. If you are flying somewhere, you're going to hope your pilot is a one, right? You're going to hope, hey, they're going to do this by the book, and they're going to do it well. So ones can oftentimes be incredibly critical as well. One of the things that I appreciate most about the Enneagram is not just that it identifies our personalities and some of the challenges with them, but what it does is it presents a path forward, a way to growth and maturity. And so the invitation for ones is this: to participate in goodness and serenity, which includes the role of the negative. The invitation for ones is this: embrace imperfection. Lighten up. Have some fun. Examples from history. I hear these things in books. I have no idea how they did. They ask these people to take an Enneagram test? I have no idea. But Martin Luther, John Calvin, these were ones. Nelson Mandela, Hillary Clinton, Michelle Obama, and Paul. The Apostle Paul from the Bible was for sure a one. If you read his stuff, he's all, grace, grace, but you're doing this wrong, right? He tends to have this moralism to him, a puritanism to him. That's ones. Nines tend to see the world through the lens of peace. They're the peacemakers. And I love nines because I'm married to one. And some of my best friends are nines, actually. But the nines tend to see the world through the lens of peace. And one of their challenges is this: they can often feel like their voice is not actually worth listening to, or that their presence isn't quite needed. When I think of nines, I think of a bus driver, a happy bus driver. You get on the bus, they welcome you, hello, hello, and then you go to the back of the bus and they're sort of removed from everything else that's happening at the back of the bus. There's conversations going on, but they feel a bit removed from it. Nines have a tendency to merge into their environment, and their wounding message is this: your opinions, your wants, your desires, your presence don't matter. So don't ruffle any feathers. The thing is, when they're healthy, they're really good at keeping the peace. Healthy nines can be phenomenal makers of peace. They can mediate impossible situations, but what they tend to do is avoid conflict like the plague. They don't want to have any sort of disagreement with others. In fact, they don't even like being unsettled on the inside. And again, the Jesus projection system, the beam in others' eyes, is they tend to see everyone else as in turmoil and conflict. And so they defend themselves by sort of saying, this isn't happening. When conflict comes up, it's, this isn't happening. This is no problem. They try to deaden their response to things. In fact, they can be passive aggressive at times. In fact, I'm told nines need more sleep than anyone else. Because to sort of merge with the energy of others, it's exhausting, which makes sense. My wife goes to bed every night at like 8, so, you know, there's something to that. But the Enneagram offers an invitation, a path to grow for us, and it's this. To participate in real peace means dealing with conflict. And for 9s, that's a very difficult thing. The invitation is this: embrace problems and conflict and learn to move towards action. The Dalai Lama, apparently, is a 9. Barack Obama, Marge Simpson, a 9. Jonah in the Bible, a 9. Runaway, I don't want to deal with that. 8s, oh, 8s. The lens of justice. Lens of justice. They're the leaders, the challengers. They have a very strong sense of justice in the world. Whenever I think of 8s, I tend to think of the image that comes to my mind. Is, remember in the 80s, the Tiananmen Square protester, and there was that guy in front of the tank, and he's like, no, not moving. That, to me, sums up 8s very well. This is an injustice. You're not moving me. And they have a very strong sense of standing up to injustice with courage. But their wounding message in life is this: the world is hostile, only the strong survive. If you are an 8 or know an 8, they have a very strong physical energy about them. They have a lot of presence. If you're in a conversation with a group of people, you will know when there's an 8 in the conversation. You will notice them. There's an intensity about them. And they can come across as angry even though they don't feel like they're being angry. And for 8s, their blind spot is this, or what they tend to try to avoid at all costs, is looking weak and vulnerable. And that's the way they project too. That can be the plank in their own eye, and yet they project on others. Everyone else seems weak and vulnerable and dependent. And so they will deny as much as they can, acknowledging any vulnerability. And for them to feel powerless or to be treated unjustly is just about the worst thing in the world. And so the invitation for the 8s is this: to participate in justice by being a conduit of mercy. The invitation for them is to embrace weakness and vulnerability. Martin Luther King Jr. was an 8. Donald Trump is for sure an 8, and a very unhealthy one at that. In the Bible, Samson, an 8. Saul, Deborah, David, 8s. And then we move to the intellect, fear, head triad. The primary issue for those in this triad is fear, boundary between the self and the world. And what this triad does is they tend to use their intellect to compensate and cope with that fear. And so 5s tend to overexpress their intellect. They flee from external fears by using their intellect. They can come across as very heady. 7s underexpress it. They can almost seem a little bit shallow. And 6s are ambivalent about it. They don't know if they're scared, and they don't know how to express it. They're a little out of touch with it. In fact, because of that, they tend to distrust themselves. So 7s, they see the world through the lens of joy. They're the enthusiasts of the world. I love 7s because they always bring a great energy to the room, you know? Whenever I think of 7s, I think of people, though, who the grass is always greener on the other side. I have a good friend who's a 7. When we go out to lunch together, it's always, what's the next thing? So he can't order from a menu. And once he does, he's like, hey, next time we come here, I'm going to try that. And then maybe the next time we do lunch, we should go to that other place. Because it's always, what's the next thing? And he's always, here's my next idea. Here's this. Oh, I can't wait to experience that. They're always sort of hopping around to the next thing. And their wounding message is this: you are on your own. And so, because of that message, what they tend to avoid at all costs is pain and suffering. Let's move on to the next joyful thing, the next fun thing. And because of that, they tend to project their fears onto other people. Other people, the lens they see others through is, other people are party poopers. That person's way too serious. That person's depressed. They're so unimaginative. Tend to project that onto others. And their defense mechanism is this. Oh, look at that grass over there. It's green. Let's go take a look at that. The primary vulnerability is this. They really do not like having limited options. They feel caged in. But the invitations to sevens is this. To participate in joy means acknowledging the role of suffering and pain. The invitation is this. Embrace depth, balance, and focus. Focus on the present, even if that includes suffering. Richard Branson is a seven. Homer Simpson is a seven, an unhealthy seven. Kramer, definitely a seven. King Solomon in the Bible is for sure a seven. Sixes, lens of loyalty and trust, the loyalists. I'm a six, and I hate it because I've been told that about 50% of people are sixes, which insults my sense of being super unique. So 50% of us are sixes. Sixes have a real trouble with trust. They don't trust themselves. They don't trust others. And this is the weird thing. Sixes can present as confident, but on the inside, they're full of doubt, which is weird because on a morning like this, I might look confident, but inside I'm like, that sucked. Oh my goodness. You should have rethought the way you think about that. And I'll spend all Sunday afternoon doing the same thing. So you can present as confident and yet be full of doubt. And because sixes don't trust themselves, they project that. They don't trust other people. I was listening to an interview with Katie Williams. She was talking about what it's like to be a six. And she said this rather dark thing, but it made me laugh. I thought it was true. She said, being a six is like this. It's like walking into a room and pointing the finger at everyone and thinking, you are all liars. And then she said, that's a bit dark, and I'm kidding, but not really. Sixes are generally with other people very suspicious. Like, what's your hidden agenda here? And our wounding message as sixes is this: you do not have it in you to make it on your own. You cannot trust yourself. Because we can't trust ourselves, we try to avoid. I don't want to be disobedient or rebellious, but I also don't want to be helpless and dependent. And so we also tend to project that onto other people. I don't trust myself. And so others are, you're inconsistent, you're untrustworthy. I don't know if I can trust you. And so our defense mechanism is paranoia, actually. Our vulnerability is, I'm unsure of who to trust. And so sixes, sometimes they look to authority figures, but they also distrust authority figures. And the invitation to sixes is this, to participate in God through trust and faith. The invitation is this, you have to embrace trust. You have to let go of that fear and let people in. Examples of Freud apparently was a six. Bono. Thank goodness, that's the one redeeming factor. Bono's a six, apparently. Apparently, lots of comedians, the higher rate of comedians are sixes because they play on their paranoia in front of people. They play on that instinct. From the Bible, Timothy and Peter were for sure sixes as well. Fives, the lens of wisdom. They are the observers and investigators. They're the ones that make me most nervous in church because they very rarely I find do they sit up front. There's just too much energy there. They like sort of sitting in the back. It's a little kind of observe and investigate from here. And they tend to be the ones who are always sort of thinking, I'm smarter than the person presenting. I know more about this person because they observe and they investigate. They're probably the smartest people in the room, to be honest. But their wounding message is this. You don't have the resources to handle relationships. You are not prepared for life. And because of that fear, they retreat to the intellect. They retreat and they observe and they investigate. And what they avoid above all other things is this, looking foolish. That hurts. So they observe, take it in. And again, that projection mechanism tends to be this. They see people through the lens of, they are ignorant. They haven't thought about this enough, not the way that I have. And so one of the ways that they compensate is to isolate themselves a little bit because they just don't want to be made to look foolish. The invitation to fives is this. Real wisdom is embodied. And so you have to embrace attachment, emotion, physicality. Many of the great philosophers were fives. I mean, most philosophers are fives. I haven't read Harry Potter, but I've heard Dumbledore. from Harry Potter. It was a five. Mary, the mother of Jesus, Thomas, Zacchaeus. These were fives. To the threes, to the value triad, the feeling, heart, image triad. For these types, persona is a major issue. It's the dominate, they cope with the world, and in fact, their personality is their coping mechanism. And so this triad is a bit different. You see, for the anger triad, anger sets boundaries for other people. For the fear triad, fear sets boundaries for the world. But for this triad, shame sets boundaries for themselves. And so I tend to find this triad is usually most sensitive to the Enneagram, as it's a hard thing to hear. If someone's pointing out that your personality is not real, it's not the real you, that's not an easy thing to hear. For someone whose personality is their primary way of understanding identity and coping with the world, this is difficult. So this triad is focused around issues of rejection and shame. Twos tend to avoid shame by overexpressing the value system of others. They hide from shame by focusing on others. Fours, on the other hand, they avoid shame by underexpressing the value systems of others. They tend to be caught up in their own emotions. And threes, like everyone in the center of their triad, they're just out of touch with their own value systems. They tend to disassociate from their emotions. So fours, they see the world through the lens of beauty, beautiful and ugly. They're the individualists, the artists. It's definitely cliche, but when I think of fours, I think of the artist alone, smoking a cigarette, working on their next idea, their artwork, their challenge. They're trying to bring their authentic self to whatever they do. And the wounding message of four is this: no one understands you, and you don't belong. And so what they try to do is avoid at all costs being ordinary or inauthentic or hypocritical. And again, that beam in the eye thing, the projection system is this: they tend to see other people's as unrefined or ordinary or hypocritical. And the way they sort of have a defense mechanism, fours typically are a little bit more melancholy than the rest of us, a little bit more restless, have a deeper sense of longing, and they just don't want to be, they hate the idea of not being noticed or recognized. And the invitation to fours is this: to participate in God is to embrace the ordinary and to understand that you are not your feelings. Examples from history: Kierkegaard, Thomas Merton, Virginia Woolf, Alanis Morissette, that's a cool one, Joseph, Jeremiah. Threes see the world through the lens of productivity. They're the achievers and motivators, so I doubt there are very many threes here because they're out taking on the world right now. They're just take it on. When I think about them, I tend to think about them as the superstar or the superhero who has just accomplished something great and sort of basking in the limelight of people taking pictures. They just, they're ambitious, super ambitious. If there's one type I'm jealous of, it's the three. They have such ambition, but their wounding message is this: you are what you do, and you are how you perform, and you are how people perceive you. And so what they do is they tend to avoid at all costs looking like a failure or being inefficient. And Jesus, the beam in the eye projection system here, is they tend to see other people as, oh, they're so inefficient, they're failures, they're inept. And so that's their vulnerability. I don't want to be rejected. I don't want to be seen as a failure. And so the invitation for threes is particularly strong to participate in truth and hope. They have to be able to separate what they do and create from who they are. They need to embrace being ineffective and inefficient. If Sabbath is for anyone, it's for type threes in particular. Oprah Winfrey is a very healthy three. In the Bible, there's some darker ones: Jacob, Judas, Pilate, but they're the achievers. Twos, finally, see the world through the lens of love. They're the helpers. When I think of twos, I think of a hotel manager. always kind of somehow in the background, a little bit above everyone else working there, but very keenly attentive to the needs of others, keenly attuned to how they might be perceived, and always right there to help. I mean, when I go to hotels now, I don't even bring toothpaste because I know I'll call the hotel manager. I forgot my toothpaste. They bring some right up. They're always, boom, right there to help, right? That's sort of the twos. How can I help? But the wounding message of twos is this: having or expressing your own needs will lead to humiliation and rejection. And so what they avoid or tend to avoid is their own needs and project that onto others. Other people are needy. Others don't have enough love or don't love enough. And so what they're scared of is rejection. If they express their needs, will they be rejected? And so the invitation for them to grow is this: to participate in grace by letting themselves be loved, allowing themselves to express and embrace their needs. Desmond Tutu is apparently a two. Mary Magdalene, Martha, and twos get the honor of Jesus being a two. So, you know, there's that. That is the quickest overview I can give. And what I hope to do this morning is to just whet your appetite a little bit. Because here's the thing, if we're going to be intentional about growing, I think we sometimes need a pathway. What is the way my personality could grow and mature? Because this is so basic, the overview. But what I love about the Enneagram is it points out sort of the false self of our personalities, but also the way we grow and mature. So I want to give you a few things as we try to wrap up this morning. The first is this: if this is any way catching your attention. If not, you're like, whatever. All right. If you're like, this is intriguing, I want to suggest a few things to you. First is, if you're a podcast person, the Unorthodoxy podcast by Duncan Rayburn is phenomenal. He's South African, so he's got a charming accent that just, he explains this over 10 episodes in a podcast. It's very sort of a nice critical analysis. But the other ones that are big right now is the Typology podcast by Ian Cron and the Road Back to You podcast by Ian Cron and Suzanne Stabile. And that's, they also have a book called The Road Back to You, which is a phenomenal primer on the Enneagram. The latest one out that I really, really loved was The Sacred Enneagram by Christopher Hertz. And there's some other books there too. I've read parts of all of these books. And if you want to go deeper, this is a great place to start. Tests. I want to talk about tests. In fact, I put a thing on the screen for you to take a test, possibly. I find tests to be very not accurate. So it took me about a year to find my number, and I scored wrong a number of times. And so they can be helpful to get you started or to eliminate what you were for sure not, but don't take a test and be like, okay, there's my number. You got to go a little bit deeper with it. And what I want to do is this. In January, once the new year gets here, because it seems like a good time to get real intentional about things and about growth, is there are a lot of you here who are experienced with the Enneagram, so I'm going to try to get some heads together, those experienced with the Enneagram, and we'll have a little chat about the best ways we could perhaps start a 4 to 6 week group that could use the Enneagram to intentionally look at ourselves in ways that we could grow and mature together. So that'll be coming in the new year. What time is it? I've got two quick. All right. I want to go through one cute thing, but I wanted to, this is just a lot of information. So I want to tell you how this has helped Kristen and I quickly, because it can be like, oh, that's a lot of information there. When Kristen identified as a nine, it really rocked our world this summer. And we spent a number of campfires chatting about what our different numbers meant. And, you'll remember the mug story I told you last Sunday about my desire to get rid of many mugs in my house. And what we realize is because nines merge, they tend to, if you're talking to them, they merge to you. So their personality becomes enmeshed with yours. Is for someone like Kristen, I'll go to her and say, hey, I got this great idea. I want to get rid of all of our mugs except for like five. And she'll say things like, well, that sounds like a good idea. And I interpret that for the past 13 years as, great, so let's do it. together. But because nines merge, what she means by that's a good idea is, I think you believe that's a good idea. Good luck with that. It doesn't necessarily mean that she's on board with it, because what I've learned about nines is it takes some time for them to suss out, what do you really think about this? And oftentimes nines need to be able to remove themselves from the situation, go and think about things. And so for the past 13 years, I've had about 1,500 great ideas that Kristen's never done anything with, and I'm starting now just to realize why. Just because she merges with my personality and thinks, hey, that's a good idea for you, doesn't mean she's interested in that. And so in remarkable ways, that's just one silly example, it's been allowing us to see each other in a new light. And the way I want to close is this, because I thought it was cute and kind of funny. Duncan Rayburn has a very quick list of the way the different types speak. And so I thought I would end with just a brief rundown the way the different types use language and speak together. And so ones, they're a little bit big on the rule keeping. They can have a bit of a bark. They're pretty definitive and can come across as a bit preachy. Nines tell epic sagas, and usually they're boring. No, I'm kidding. But no, they can get lost into them. My friend Riley is a nine, and you'll be like 15 minutes into a story, be like, I don't know where you're going with this. It's because they sort of merge with their environment, and they tell these epic sagas. Eights talk in exclamation points. It's sort of shoot first, ask questions later, or fire, ready, aim. I mean, think Donald Trump, just tweeting out things, just fire. Away you go, exclamation point. Sevens, they speak in anecdotes. They got lots of little stories because they love experience and they go looking for experience, so they actually have lots of great stories, so they love to tell anecdotes. Sixes, this has been a huge realization for me. We talk in disclaimers. So be like, so here's this thing, but yeah, it might be, I don't know. And that's why so many people hate the way I teach, because I'm like, so here's this thing, but disclaimer, I might not be 100% sure of that. Fives are the teachers. Teach, explain, map, elaborate. They have so much to offer. Fours, I love this, they talk in poetic lament. Things are never great for fours, but they're attuned to beauty. No one can capture beauty like a four. They're very empathic. Threes are a sales pitch, and they're usually selling themselves. They're the product. They motivate. They can lift the room. I have two great friends that are threes. When they walk into the room, it goes from to just energy in the air. And twos tend to talk in other people's needs. They're incredibly compassionate, even with strangers, but they can often, how are you doing, two? Great. Now let me ask you how you are and tell me more about that. They talk in the language of other people's needs. Again, this is hyperbolic and stereotypical, but hopefully this gives you a final sort of overview of the way the different types work. So, I hope perhaps this morning allowed you to get maybe a little bit of a taste for what you might be, and maybe it kind of, I think it was Ruth yesterday, like, make it kind of like a wine tasting. So, here's the taste. I hope you buy the bottle, basically, and go looking and explaining and thinking a little bit more deeper about the Enneagram, because I think it's a great tool. It's just a tool, but it's a great tool for helping us understand ourselves, the ways we project our wounding message, and the ways we can grow and mature. So I'm just going to pray quickly, and then Dave, if you could, or could you man the mirror us out? Could you just give us that? That would be lots of fun. So why not pray, and we will do that and go from here. Wonderful. Is it 11:30? Yeah, so no time for questions. All right. Let's pray. God, thank you that you have made us complex and mysterious creatures. And we pray that by your Spirit, you would increasingly help us to become aware of who we are, the masks we hide behind, the personalities we hide behind. Let us see us for who we truly are, children made in the image of God. And allow us to understand the ways we've been wounded and broken over the years and how those messages have shaped and formed our personalities. So take us away from here with a curiosity, a drive to understand ourselves better and how to mature and grow to be more like you. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Go in peace.